At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast, the Christmas special. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. I have to say, I'm going to confess something here. I can't stand Christmas specials. They seem forced. Now, I love Christmas. I'm not a Grinch. Love Christmas. Have the, you know, the Santa hat and do the elves. And we have all these Christmas traditions we follow. I don't like Christmas specials. They seem like, you know, you're rolling stuff out. So we're going to try and not do that. We're doing a brand new feature, which is fascinating, where we're going to speak to Ken Dark, an archaeologist who claims to have found the house that Jesus grew up in. Jesus of Nazareth, his home, his actual gaff. Ken Dark claims to have found it. We'll be hearing his case. But first, it's time to look back at the best stories of the year. And we're going to choose ones that maybe slipped under the radar because of the virus that we shall not speak its name. Lots of other amazing discoveries just pass us by. And to take us through them, we're joined by Dr. Susan Kelleher and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. I hope you had a good Christmas. How are you feeling? Feeling
good.
Festive?
How are you?
Yeah, good. Yeah. Good. Susan?
I am on holiday.
Great. Yeah, I'm currently wearing a Christmas jumper.
Nice. Is it the same one you wear every year?
No, I went in and got a new one. I just felt the year needed a new jumper.
Tis the season for Christmas jumpers.
Yes.
Do you know, I did look for my Santa hat for this, even though it's a radio program and we're on Zoom. But I couldn't find it. So there you go.
Good effort.
I think that makes it a Christmas special. We've asked you how Christmas is. We've talked about Christmas jumpers. I hate these things. Let's just go into our first story.
She said you'd fold faster than Superman on laundry day.
We'll see about that.
Our first story, Susan, has to do with protein folding and AI. And this is a story that really did go under the radar, but really, really impressive science. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a story, like you said, you know, it's potentially gone a bit unnoticed over the year with the other stories, but it's one of the greatest scientific problems that scientists have been trying to answer over the last 50 years. And this year, a solution has been found, and it's all to do with the predicting of protein folding. So we need to think about what proteins are for a second to realize the enormity of this. So proteins are molecules in our bodies, and they're responsible for so many things. They are the antibodies that protect us, and they're the muscle that makes us move. And they're essentially within our bodies, the machines that make us do everything. They're the things that make us who we are. But they're really complicated. And of course, because different proteins do different things, they really are very complicated and bespoke in a lot of ways. So if you think of them, we know that they're big, long strands of atoms held together. And they're different units of what we call the amino acids. So I like to think of them in the Christmas spirit that it is. I like to think of it like a long strand of Christmas lights with different colors on them. So you've got different patterns of the colors, or they're the different amino acids in the Christmas lights. Now, the problem, of course, we know with Christmas lights is that they get tangled very, very quickly into a big ball in terms of a 3D shape or a structure. Now, they can be very complicated to unfold. And if you think about the protein in the same way, so that it's starting to fold into these different shapes. Now, the shapes are essential because two things make a protein what it is. The first is the shape, and the second thing is the sequence of the colors, the sequence of the amino acids on the Christmas lights. So how proteins fold and how they make their shapes and how the different lights interact with one another makes them really unique and makes the difference between a muscle cell or a protein and say an antibody or insulin that's going to, you know, control your sugar levels. So the way that scientists usually have to figure out how proteins fold is that essentially they have to take a photograph of them using X-ray crystallography or different types of spectroscopes that look at these molecules, and it's really hard. There's around 200 million proteins that we know of, and we actually only know how they fold up or the shape of them of about 100,000 of them. So that's not really, considering the structure tells us what the protein does or tells us how it acts or what it does in the body, you know, we really don't know a lot about the proteins that we are made up of. So what this company does, it's called DeepMind, and they are a Google company, and they've made this a program called AlphaFold. And what they've looked at is using computational methods, or essentially an algorithm, to predict how a long strand of amino acids would fold into the particular protein. And the really nice thing that they've done is they've basically solved the problem of how good can we get the prediction. So there's a competition that's been running since 1994, every 2 years, and about 100 computational scientists come into the competition, and they try to figure out the shape of a protein or a number of different proteins that this company sets for them for the competition. And to date, up to about a couple of years ago, the best that people got was around 50-60%. And this year, with this AI-driven algorithm, DeepMind and AlphaFold have got to over 90%. And they say that once you get past 90%, it's essentially the same as being shrunk down into the body and going and drawing a picture of the thing as you see it in front of you. So it now, really is outstanding.
Why do we want to know the shapes of these proteins? Why is that important?
Great. So proteins, the shape of them determines what they do. And if you think about proteins in the body like a lock and a key, you can think about every protein, the shape of it like a keyhole will fit a certain molecule that then goes and does the next thing. So if you don't have the right shape in the keyhole, the key won't fit. And so we won't actually be able to figure out, like we won't be able to understand what keys need to fit in, what drugs will fit in. And therefore, we don't really know how the proteins work unless we know the shape and the structure of them.
So really important for medicine, drug development and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the biggest things in drug development is understanding how the drugs get to where they're going and then what they fit into in order to work. So if we can understand this at this level and predict it, we can design drugs. Like, it's just going to change the whole scene. It's great.
Our next story has to do with habitable planets, Shane. And I'm surprised you picked this as one of your biggest stories of the year, because it seems like they come along more regularly than the 46A.
I felt this story was very impressive because it shows that despite like the real need for scientists to get behind like the virus that shall not be named, physicists have not been deterred to do their quirky science. And this is a perfect example of such a story. And it came out in the middle of the pandemic and people probably didn't notice it. It's very quirky. So it's based on work done in the Silesian University and around a professor's class with undergraduates, where he said to them, you know, the film Interstellar, where astronauts travel through a wormhole and visit several planets orbiting a black hole. He said, I wonder, would that be possible? Would you be able to have a habitable planet orbiting a black hole? And he was teaching a class on thermodynamics. And he said, thermodynamics is the basis for life. That's the way a physicist would approach the complexity of biology, right? Where you have a heat source, which would be a sun, and a heat sink, which would be the coolness of space. And the dynamic between that is going to set the gradient on which life will form. And so he and his undergraduate class postulated that could happen around a black hole. And in this paper that they published, they worked out the conditions under which that would happen. And they are, as you might think, rather extreme and extremely unlikely. But it shows physics at its best and the ability to be able to, you know, take something and run a thought experiment on it and really bring it forward to see whether this is feasible or not.
But they didn't actually find this habitable planet going around a black hole.
Oh, God, no, no. And like the conclusion of this is it's extremely unlikely. So like, and what's very quirky in this setup is that the heat source here is the cosmic microwave background, you know, the fuzz since the Big Bang. In the extreme gravitational environment of orbiting a black hole, this would be sort of crunched into more visible light, and it would form the source of heat, and the black hole is going to be the sink, and so that's the gradient that life may come up around. This black hole would have to be absolutely massive. They reckon 163 solar masses. That's 163 times the mass of our sun. And the night sky would look amazing. More than half of the night sky, or the day sky rather, would be a giant black hole. So the blackest thing you could imagine.
That would be a very good planet for the next season of The Mandalorian, wouldn't it? look, it's very cool. Is it one of the biggest stories of the year? I'm not entirely sure. So your next story better be good, and it better not be about dogs. That's all I'm going to say. Our third story, Susan, is about microbes that have been asleep for over 100 million years. This is a very cool story.
Yeah, this caught my imagination because of the possibilities of other things we might find out, you know. So basically what Japanese scientists have done is they've looked at sediment that was lying on the seabed. And this is around 6 kilometers down in the Pacific Ocean. Now, to put that in perspective, the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the ocean, or the deepest part place on Earth, is around 10 kilometers down. So this is really far down in the ocean. And they took samples from the seabed, and they thought to themselves, what could be here that may not be dead? When you think of that far down in the ocean, we know that light doesn't get down there. We know that there's no oxygen. So life as we know it is really not common. And it's very unusual to think that something might be surviving down there. But what they did was they took these samples back to the lab, and they isolated some microbes that they didn't know if they were dead or dormant. And what they did was they fed them some carbon and some nitrogen, which they need to be able to eat and replicate. And then they gave them back some oxygen. And they replicated they revived to about 99% of the microbes that were in the dish revived. Now, these are, as you said, 100 million years old. So this is the age of the dinosaurs, that these bacteria would have gone dormant down in the bottom of the seabed. And they said that basically they started with around 100 cells per cubic centimeter. And after 68 days, they got to 1 million cells. So not only did they manage to make it across the line and revive, but they really thrived. So I think it's fascinating because we've only explored about 5% of our oceans. And the seabed, the marine sediment, makes up about 70% of the Earth's surface. So what else is down there, you know, from millions and millions of years ago? And then to understand that we can revive it and to bring it back to life is...
That's a good idea, Susan. Killer diseases down there that we're digging up now. Brilliant.
That's really cool. Are these the oldest living things in on the planet now? They must be, surely.
Well, actually, I haven't thought about that, but that would make sense because, I mean, there's nothing else that's older than that. So, yes, lying dormant and being revived is alive, and they are replicating. And so, yeah, I think that little dish, if they're still going, it's somewhere in a Japanese research
facility.
They're
creating Godzilla.
Yeah, they're getting there. But I mean, in terms of what they're going to bring back up, you have to think about, you know, things that live at the bottom of the sea or things that are down there, potentially not the things that are going to be infecting us, or, you know, they're not looking for animal hosts, I would hope. Yeah. Time will tell, Shane. Time will tell.
Well, two excellent stories of the year, Susan. We're looking back at some of the stories that may have just slipped under the radar because of COVID. It is a Christmas special. And our final story, Shane, it better not be about dogs. What is it about?
Yeah, our final story is about dogs, Jonathan, and a new sense that's been discovered in dogs, the ability to detect heat. And they do this using their nose.
Ah.
Yeah. Now, the first thing I thought of was like, sure, we can all detect heat. Like, you know, you're standing in front of the fire or you're in a cold room. But what actually happens there is that the larger object and you will come to a new thermal equilibrium, and the change in temperature is what you detect. So you're not actually detecting the heat. You know, you're detecting the change in temperature for you. So the dog is able to do something different. Like snakes, like some bats and like some beetles, that they have an infrared detector in their nose. Which is incredible and completely undiscovered until this year. Late February, this paper was published when perhaps we were all looking elsewhere. And what they did in this experiment that was run in Lund is they trained dogs to choose between two objects. One was at room temperature and one was at 31 degrees Celsius. And apart from that, they were completely indistinguishable. Same smell, same look, identical. And they trained them to detect the differences between them. And they were able to do this in a double-blind setup, so that they were able to determine that the dog can distinguish between them based on temperature alone. They also hooked up the dogs to functional MRI scanners. while they were confronted with or exposed to objects of certain temperatures. And they saw that certain parts of their brain lit up a lot more if the object was warmer. This is absolutely incredible. Of course, a whole new sense for our little four-legged friends, John. And I know it's been a very special year for you on the dog front too.
It has. This has been a great year for me because I got Roxy, our beloved fifth member of the family, finally something in the house I can love. And I do love dogs. I do. I have also put a jumper on my dog. So I'm slacking you, Shane, but I am also one with you this Christmas time.
You're one step away from putting a dry robe on that dog.
I will say, how do we know dogs haven't got X-ray vision?
We don't.
So. We haven't tested it. See, because last week we found out that the kangaroos can communicate with people and say, "Hey, help me open this jar. Will you? There's food inside." Dogs can smell heat. Maybe they've got X-ray vision. Maybe if we just keep asking these animals questions, we'll find out that we're pretty useless. Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD, a very happy Christmas. And a happy Christmas to all of our contributors, Lara, Jessamine, everybody, Ruth, everyone who's on regularly giving us the news of the year. Thank you so much. We really do appreciate it. Shane, Susan, happy Christmas. See you later. This is a Christmas special. And so we thought we'd look at the evidence around the life of Jesus. Christmas is the time of the birth of Jesus, and yet we don't really know an enormous amount of Jesus's life based from archaeological evidence. Well, we're going to talk about that now. We're joined by Professor Ken Dark. He's an archaeologist at Reading University, and he's author of The Sisters of Nazareth Convent, a Roman period Byzantine and Crusader site in central Nazareth. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Ken. Can you tell us a little bit about the world in which Jesus Christ was born? Tell us about Nazareth, where it is, what it looks like today.
Okay. Jesus was born into the world of the Roman Empire. He lived in a colony of the Roman Empire, a province within an empire that was run by the distant authority in Rome, ultimately the authority of the emperor. Now, Jesus's village, Nazareth, was a very small place. We don't quite know how big it was, but it was certainly not a town in the normal sense of the word. And it was in an agricultural part of one of the Roman provinces, an area called Galilee, which is now in the north of Israel. It's today a city of about 60,000 people, and it's distinguished by being the largest Arab Israeli city in Israel.
What was life like at that time for someone who would have born around the same time of Jesus?
The everyday life of somebody living in a Galilean village would have centered around farming. These were farming communities, taking flocks out into the fields, planting crops, and also producing a certain amount of crafts products, whether that's pottery or glass, or for that matter, woodwork or stonework. They were living in a world in which their own community may have been quite self-sufficient, but the world around them was integrated into the broader economy and, in some places, the broader culture of the Roman Empire.
I hate to admit it, but most of my imaginings of what the life of and times of the young Jesus are based on the life of Brian. And I'm wondering, did they trade in shekels? The image portrayed in the life of Brian, is that something that we imagine Nazareth might have looked like?
The reality is quite different. For example, there's absolutely no evidence that in Nazareth at the time of Jesus's childhood, money was at all commonly used. Mm. There's only one first century coin from all the excavation that has been done in Nazareth, and that's from later than the time of Jesus. it looks as if this was largely a non-monetary economy, an economy in which people would have exchanged goods and services without using coinage. It was a society in which life would have centered around a family and those families taking part in the communal life of the village. So maybe attending a synagogue, whatever synagogue meant at this time. Some people think there was an actual building. Other people think it was an outdoor assembly. And perhaps going to some kind of market, either in Nazareth or somewhere nearby. That sort of life, not the sort of Roman Empire you see in epic movies with legions and people in purple cloaks.
What sources of information do we have of this time?
The Roman Empire as a whole, of course, is quite well documented, but essentially that written evidence becomes less and less the lower you go down the social scale. So that former life of everyday farming people across most of the Roman Empire, and Nazareth would be part of that, we rely on archaeological evidence much more than written sources. Though, ironically, a famous quotation from about the early Roman Empire in general is that if you want to know what the life of low status people was like in the Roman Empire, you could read the Gospels and that will give you as clear a picture as anything else of how everyday folk lived in the empire. So in a way, the life depicted in the Gospels is not one which we generally have documented, but because their writers were interested in events that concern somebody's life who didn't grow up in great luxury, wasn't part of the elite, and because most of the followers of that person, Peter and Matthew and all these people, were not elite people themselves, then what we see is a glimpse of lower status life. And of course, the Gospels were written relatively close in time to the events they describe compared to the sources we often use to reconstruct the Roman Empire. So it's quite a mistake to see them as necessarily unreliable sources. But of course, like all written sources, whether they're about Queen Boadicea or about Jesus Christ, they're all written from a perspective. And obviously, the people writing the Gospels were writing it from one or another Christian perspective.
Tell me about your particular interest in archaeology. What do you look for and what drives you?
Well, I'm an archaeologist who works on the first 1,000 years AD. I'm not what the Americans would call a biblical archaeologist. I don't go around with a Bible in one hand and a trowel in the other, seeking to prove, or for that matter, disprove facts or statements in the Bible. What I go about trying to do, by contrast, is to understand the Roman world and its transition into the world of the Middle Ages, which is ultimately the origin of that in which we live. So I was in Nazareth not to find Jesus or something like that. I was in Nazareth to study the emergence of the Byzantine, the 5th, 6th, 7th century pilgrimage center in Nazareth that Christians came to from across the Roman Empire, rather than to find anything earlier.
And so your work took various twists and turns and landed you at the Convent of the Sisters of Nazareth, which is in Israel. Tell me about this convent.
The Sisters of Nazareth convent is right in the heart of ancient Nazareth, as we usually understand that. It's just across the road to a very famous church, said to be the largest in the Middle East today, a church of the Annunciation. It's built on the place where Christians have long believed the angel told the Virgin Mary that she was going to have Jesus. On the Sisters of Nazareth site, the nuns had discovered in the 1880s and proceeded to excavate themselves in one of the very earliest excavations initiated, directed, and undertaken solely by women. They found an archaeological site, if you like, a series of ruins on the site of their convent as they were building the convent. So the buildings, the late 19th century and early 20th century buildings were going up across the convent site, and they kept discovering things. It was pretty much unknown to the world of archaeology, at least outside a few specialists, until I began work there in 2006.
And this convent, you found out, was previously used with another purpose, which leads us to this remarkable discovery.
Before, it was a modern convent. It was used for a crusader and earlier Byzantine church. The church had never been discovered before my archaeological work there. That was an interesting discovery in itself, but what was even more interesting was we can tell which church this was by looking at written sources. And it was a church which modern scholars call the Church of the Nutrition. That is to say, the place where Jesus was nurtured or brought up. And the Byzantines believed that in the crypt of this church, the cellar, there was the very house preserved in which Jesus was brought up. Well, we found the church, we found the crypt, the cellar, and we found in it a house built about the time of Jesus and lived in by a Jewish family at about that time.
Now, how can you know that?
Well, we know that on normal archaeological grounds. We can date it due to the pottery and the other objects and the relationship between the house walls and other archaeological features.
So there was this crypt, the house that had, there were items in the crypt.
It was, no, there was... the crypt was built to contain the ruins of the house.
Oh, wow!
The house was decorated with mosaics and almost certainly the source of veneration in the Byzantine period. Before those mosaics were added to it, before the Byzantine period, the site had been used for various other Roman things, for example, a quarry and a cemetery. But before that, there'd been the first century house that the Byzantines later venerated. The house itself was a fairly simple building, typical in many respects, apart from being cut back into the rocky slopes of the hill it was built against. And that led to its better preservation than most first century low status buildings.
So let me get this straight. There was a church, and on that on the site of the convent, there was ruins that the wider world had never heard about because
yes,
they had been excavated by non-archaeological clergy, but originally nuns and then others.
Yes.
And on that site, there's an old church. Inside that church is a crypt. And inside that crypt in Nazareth are the remains of a house that has been decorated after the fact.
Decorated almost certainly because it was a source of veneration by the people who built the church in the 5th century AD.
I mean, how common is it to put a house in a crypt?
There's only one other Byzantine church in the Holy Land. There are over 150 known, but there's only one other Byzantine church in the Holy Land which stands above a 1st century house, and that was the one built above what the Byzantines believed was the house of St. Peter in Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee.
I know you haven't claimed that this is the house of Jesus, but as you've described it there, it seems like a very, very good guess at what it might be and how it might have been preserved. It's exactly as you might imagine the house of Jesus would be and where it would be. Has this been disputed by other archaeologists? Because I know archaeologists love to fight with each other.
Well, archaeologists are quite contentious in their arguments, it's true. Yeah. But when I've presented this at academic conferences internationally and nationally or research seminars, I have not actually had any professional archaeologist dispute what I really say about the site, that sequence that I've told you. They would know that I, as you say, don't claim it's the house of Jesus. What I claim, in contrast to some of the reports you might have heard, what I actually claim is that the Byzantines thought this was the house of Jesus. The presence of the cave church probably means it was thought to be the house of Jesus back in the 4th century AD, in the 300s.
Yeah.
But whether it was, well, it's a house from the 1st century and it's on that particular site. The Byzantines could have been right. The people in the 4th century could have been right. So essentially, my position is we are in no position to tell whether it really was the house of Jesus or they were mistaken, but there is no reason, archaeological reason, that is, to say it's impossible.
Let me ask you another question. Were there any writings, designs, scrolls or scripts outside that house that announced it as the house of Jesus? Or is it just the manner in which it's preserved leads you to believe that this is how it would have been preserved if it was the house of Jesus?
No, there's a written description of the Church of the New Tradition, the Byzantine Church of the New Tradition, from the 7th century, just after the Byzantine period.
But I mean in the crypt itself.
No, nothing like that.
Well,
we wouldn't expect it. We wouldn't expect people in a Galilean village in the 1st century to put up a sign saying, "This is the house of anybody." They just didn't do that.
Yeah, okay.
But also, we might have thought there would be some kind of inscriptions from a Byzantine church or even the Crusader church, but they were quite badly preserved, not least because the Byzantine church had plainly fallen down before it was built up again by the Crusaders. So all kinds of stonework could have been taken away. We have one fragment of an inscription from the Byzantine church that frustratingly seems to say either the Greek word for blessing, or it might say the Greek word Christos, Christ, but it doesn't say any more. It's just a fragment. The Crusader church was thoroughly burnt down, almost certainly deliberately burnt down. And that event can be archaeologically dated very precisely to just before or around the year 1200. That's a purely archaeological date. But Crusader Nazareth was destroyed in 1187. So that fits in quite well with the destruction of Crusader Nazareth. So my working interpretation on that is that when Nazareth fell in, well, it was actually on the 4th of July, 1187, the church was burnt down, and that's when that was destroyed.
Is this the Holy Grail, no pun intended, of archaeology? I mean, to discover something like this is enormous, right? I mean, yeah. What was it like when you made this discovery, and what effect has it had on the site in terms of visitors and so on?
Yeah. It's had surprisingly little effect on the site. It's inside a working convent, and access to the visible part of a site, not you can't see all that the nuns once excavated. It's just a small part, fortunately for us, including the house, which has been preserved by the nuns in what they call the cellar, but is actually a very large underground shelter. It goes right the way through from the front garden of the convent, underneath one of the whole blocks of the convent, into the back garden. When I first went there, I'd been told they'd got a tomb in a cellar, and I thought they meant the sort of thing you have underneath your stairs, but this is a big thing. But of course, it wasn't known about outside the convent and a few pilgrims and church people. But in terms of the wider reception of the site, of the, you know, of my work there, it's just been amazing. I mean, it's gone all the way around the world. Mm. I mean, last week, just as an example, I've been constantly doing media things since this was in the Times on the 23rd of November. But last week, I broadcast on one Russian channel, which informed me, oh, you're broadcasting to 135 million people.
Ken, what about how you felt when you realized that you had gotten the timings correct and all signs pointed to the fact that this was most likely where Jesus lived?
Well, I suppose there were two reactions to that. First of all, I was surprised. It's not the sort of thing as a secular Roman archaeologist you expect to find. I mean, I certainly wasn't going there looking for it. I was, I would imagine as surprised as anybody by it. And the second reaction was, I realised that there would be very wide interest in it. I didn't quite anticipate the fact that, you know, for example, in the last month, it's been reported over 1,500 times around the world.
It's a pretty big story, Ken.
Thankfully, I've not had to do radio interviews for all of those, or I'd have done very little else. Yes, it's obviously of sustained global interest, because really, ever since it first became a story anywhere, which was back in 2015, there's been some reporting of it somewhere in the world. But over the last month, since the book's been out, it's really been quite intense.
But was it thrilling? Was it thrilling, the realization?
Of course. There's an element of excitement. But people often overestimate how the emotions of this work. You're there with a team of professional archaeologists with a job to do. We don't spend our time sort of going, wow, this is amazing. We've got to get on with doing all the meticulous recording bit, you know, drawing things stone by stone to scale, and taking very detailed photographs, making very detailed written records. Your time is taken up when you're there with the technicalities of it, in a sense, and with trying to understand. Bear in mind, these things haven't got signs on them saying this is a Byzantine wall. You have to work that out using logic and evidence. And so, especially being the site director, you don't have a lot of time to think about it in non-professional terms. I mean, now I can see the excitement of it. And in fact, the next thing I'm going to try and do is to write a book for the general public, not a technical archaeological report. And I'm looking for a publisher for that right now.
Well, good luck with that, Ken. I'm sure it'll be a fantastic read when it comes out. We'll chat to you then. Professor Ken Dark from the University of Reading, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting, isn't it? I mean, to be honest, there's not a huge amount of science in that piece. We didn't get too much into the methodology, but I thought the story was really fascinating. And what a find. Like, what an amazing thing to have discovered in your lifetime. Right, it's time to look back at our texts and tweets from last week. And producer Aidan McKelvey joins us to go through those. What did you make of that piece?
It's definitely amazing, and it's a really cool find. But if you will allow me, I might nitpick a tiny bit, or is that just something that's going to annoy people?
Sure.
I think just from a historical point of view, you know, it does sound like it's of the era, and it does sound like people 100 years later were like, did you know this was Jesus's house? But I find it highly, highly unlikely that there were enough records for it to be definitely Jesus's house, because, you know, obviously when he was born, as far as people at the time are concerned, he's a nobody. So
but there's only two houses buried like this in crypts. One is St. Peter's, and the other one is Jesus's house. And there was a bit of brick that said Christ.
Jesus was here.
I mean, it sounds like it was pretty close to Jesus was here. I was convinced by it. I was talking to my wife about it, and she said, aha, so you agree that Jesus existed? And I'm like, yeah. And then she went a bit red, and I was like, no, I never doubted Jesus existed. I doubted he was a magic person. That's what I doubt. I don't think he was magic. I think he was a normal person. I suppose it's time to look at your comments from last week, your texts and tweets. And I thought, because it was Christmas week or the run up to it, that it would be kind of quiet. But actually, in the Googleplex, which is the nickname I've given to the texts and email machine, Aidan, there's loads of comments. People seem to be well into gravity. They seem to be drawn to it as a subject.
Yeah. I mean, people drawn to it. Oh, my God.
top
notch.
Only in the podcast can we get away with such nerdy jokes. But before we get into the gravity tweets and texts, which we did with Ethan Siegel, who looks just like you would expect someone who talks about, you know, quantum travel and gravity and time. We were talking about the most accurate clock. We had Shane Bergen in the news tell us about a new type of clock that's more accurate than the clock we're using, which is based on the vibration of atoms. We're already using a pretty accurate clock. He said that since the beginning of the universe, it's only lost a minute. So that's pretty accurate.
That was ridiculous, yeah.
Why we would need a more accurate clock than that is just beyond me. But someone texted in saying, how can you be sure it's correctly set? And that sounds like a silly question or a joke, but actually, I asked Shane the same. I was like, how do you know this is more accurate if you don't have a clock to measure it by, because that's a better clock? But Shane gave me an answer, and I was too ashamed to say I didn't understand it at the time. Did you understand it?
I think I got it. And I was actually screaming at the audio going, somebody ask him this question. So I was delighted you asked him, how do you know the most accurate clock is very accurate? Just, it didn't make any sense to me. But it seemed to me what he said was that at the quantum level, particles have like a resonance. And if you measure them versus the atomic clock over a period of time, their resonance stays more consistent. That's what I was getting from. So like, it's, you know.
But how do you know it's more consistent if your clock can't measure that consistency?
Well, I guess you could say, you could say it, but yeah. I was assuming you could count the vibrations over a certain period of time.
With what? Like, yes. I don't get it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe,
and
maybe.
May I say, it also sounds like you don't get it either.
I thought I got it.
Right. So on gravity and relativity, we got a text in from John from Navin. He says, just wondering, if I walk from the back of the moving train to the front, am I going faster than the train? Says John. And yes, you would be going faster than the train, because the train is only going at the speed the train's going, but you're going the speed of the train's going plus your walking speed. We see starlight billions of light years away. Are they still there? Says another texter. We don't know. We'll find out, I suppose, if they go out. We only find out, you know, a few minutes later. We'd find out from the sun 8 minutes later. We'd find out from stars billions of light years away from, you know, our great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will find out, but we will never know. Is that right? That's right, I think.
Yeah, that's right, John. There's definitely stars, loads out there that must not be there anymore that we're looking at.
MJ says, they say light can't escape from inside a black hole because the space is falling into the black hole faster than the speed of light. Does that not translate to the speed of gravity? Light can't escape from inside a black hole because the space is falling into the black hole faster than the speed of light. Does that not translate to the speed of gravity? In other words, should there not be any gravitational pull from a black hole? Maybe there isn't from the center, but there is mass coming out the sides, the secretion, isn't there? That was my understanding. Sort of like my understanding is it's they're leaky at the sides, black holes. But that's a good question. Like if light doesn't escape a black hole, how can gravity escape a black hole?
Yeah, but light isn't or gravity isn't a particle. Light is a particle, so it's.
Yeah, but if it's space itself is that's pulled into the black hole, gravity has to travel through space.
Yes, but the space outside the black hole isn't. It's like that thing they were saying. They say about putting a bowling ball on a sheet of fabric. That's what Eden Segal said. So it's the effect. It's not pulling. It's not going to pull the ends of the fabric in. It's just putting a sort of it's like bending it slightly.
Okay.
So it will suck. It will suck in planets, but it won't suck in space itself. It just has an impact on space, is my understanding.
I see. David Jarrett says, energy creates its own gravity. It slows the vibrations down enough to become visible. Effectively, the gravity acts like mass in an atom. Anything without mass can travel at the speed of light, photons, gluon, and gravitational waves, for instance. Energy creates its own gravity. It slows the vibrations down. I don't understand that. I'm sorry. Thank you, David, though. Hopefully, there are people who are listening to this who are smarter than me and don't know that, and now they know it. Salvo Laterza from Dimensione Terra, which sounds like Earth Dimension, says, I've listened to the podcast episode. When a star is born, it starts fusion of early elements, therefore shines light. But how can that escape a gravity which is already there, given the mass of the gases simply coalesced and didn't increase? Why doesn't it for black holes? Salva, I'm going to put you in the David Jarrett camp and just say, you know, for these ones, I'm just going to sort of look cute and twiddle my thumbs. I have no idea, A, what you're asking, and B, what the answer is. Do you know what's going on there, Aidan?
No, that's why I got my silence.
At least you're honest this time. At least you're honest. David Jarrett tries one more time. He says, Jonathan, for God's sake, if we're part of an expanding universe, with everything accelerating in front going faster and behind slower, does that mean everything will disappear from view eventually? I guess it must. But then I'm going to put you and yourself and Salvo all in the same sort of lovely question. Very clever question indeed. But I it's way beyond my level of understanding. I get the analogies. When a scientist says, it's kind of like a donut, I'm like, it's like a donut. It's just like a donut. If it's not like a donut in any other way, I don't understand.
Well, we did talk before about, I can't remember the guest offhand, but about how the universe would end. And that definitely, eventually it would all dissipate into single atoms over trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of years. So yeah, everything we see in the sky will disappear. And so will we.
Okay. Michael from Waterford City says, hi Jonathan, great show with Ethan Siegel and the speed of gravity, and every week for that matter. Thank you. However, still waiting for somebody to explain which is the actual universe. Did the Big Bang create the whole universe and the stuff in it, or did it just create the stuff in the universe? The universe was already there. If so, what created the universe then? Show idea maybe. So I see what you're saying. I think there was nothingness. There was no space or time is the idea before a Big Bang. So the universe didn't exist. Everything, time and space and matter, floomped out of an infinitesimally tiny point. That's what they say anyway. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah. We've entered the realms of philosophy there. So we can actually pass on that one legitimately, I think.
Excellent, excellent. Birds and dinosaurs. We were talking to Jing May O'Connor about birds and how they became birds. And someone says, what is the smallest bird that ever flew? I don't know. Is this a joke? It sounds like it's the beginning of a joke. What's the smallest bird that flew?
I would. Well, the smallest bird that flies would be hummingbird.
Flew. So before, like, that's ever been. Was there really, 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 really tiny bird?
That I don't know, but at least I had something. I gave you the current one. Current record holder.
And Mary was talking about the news that kangaroos can communicate by looking at something and then looking back at you and looking at the thing that they want you to open and looking back at you and then looking at the thing and going, I really want what's in it. And then looking at you and going, open it, please. And Mary says, oh, my God, Jonathan, where have these scientists been for 40 years? Did they not watch Skippy? Which actually is true. Skippy could do all those things. But Skippy was, of course, a domesticated kangaroo. And also
fictional.
Quite a kangaroo, quite a womanizer for a kangaroo, apparently. Yeah, but fictional. But still, they trained Skippy to do a whole bunch of stuff that these scientists would have. I mean, they would have fallen out of their seats if they saw Skippy. If they were impressed by just a head turn by a kangaroo, they should watch Skippy. Like, Skippy did all sorts of... I think it was an episode where Skippy drove a car. So, you're right, Mary. You're absolutely right. Someone says, just discovered News Talk. What a great program. We'll be tuning in each week from here on. Science well explained and understandable. Well, thanks, Ola Halober. And then Dio Reardon says, this program is excellent. Congratulations to Jonathan and his team. And I suppose, Aidan, in some way, technically, on paper, you would be on that team. So that congratulations is part shared with you, although
yes,
you're unnamed. Aidan, listen, happy Christmas, mate.
Yeah, you too.
Because we're recording this before Christmas, I'll be honest with you. We didn't record this on Stephen's Day, do we, Aidan?
No, I was... 23rd. Going to try and pretend. I was going to see what your acting skills are like.
No. Christmas specials shouldn't be Christmas specials. There should just be no Christmas special. I love Christmas. I just don't like Christmas specials.
Because you're like,
because I shouldn't have to work the week up to Christmas on Future Proof. No one's going to listen to this program. If you listen to this program, email us now, science@newstalk.com, and say yes. On the 26th of December, with all of the stuff going on in the world, I sat down to listen to a good old episode of Future Proof. And if you did, I will eat my hat. Okay? So let them come in. Take a second now. Pop out your phone. Just email saying, listened, McRae, or listened, or you're wrong, to science@newstalk.com. Honestly, I'd be surprised if we got 3 emails. Genuinely, I bet you, 20 quid.
What's this tree talk? You already said one will make you eat your hat.
Well,
and I've about
15 emails.
Generally, I tend to listen back to the podcast just as the way
three
to
times,
see what I've
three times by any chance.
I don't need to. You brought the tree thing.
Whatever. Look, you're turning me into a Christmas Grinch here. What are you doing? What are you doing for the Christmas that's already happened?
Stuff that I've been doing that's already happened. I'm basically just staying in my parents' house because myself and my brother and I say it's been very nice because we haven't been together for a long time, so we've all been isolating in the run up to Christmas.
How much did you have for Christmas dinner together? Was it good? In the future?
Oh yeah, it's always good. My mother knows how to make a great Christmas dinner, and we have a tradition of watching John Carpenter's The Thing at Christmas.
Excellently weird tradition. Well done, you.
Yeah.
We go to the zoo and have donuts. We go to the zoo and have donuts. I mean, that's actually not a joke. That's our Christmas tradition. All right, listen. Well done. It was a tricky old year for you, and you slogged through. Kept on going like one of those, dogs pulling something heavy. Fair dues. We'll be back, I suppose, at more in another episode that people won't listen to next week, and then hopefully people will come back and start listening, where we'll do some proper stuff. So in the meantime, thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, and Stephen McLoone, who was on sound. We will see you. There's a good bit in the podcast extra next Tuesday, and that is about snowflakes. You can check that one out just for a bit of crack, but you won't. We'll see you in January when you'll actually start listening again. In the meantime, stay curious. Happy Christmas, Aidan.
Happy Christmas, Jonathan, and to all of our listeners.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.